Now just a few words about the connections between monks and laity. The connections obviously are very close, because every family has someone in the robes. Every family has got a son or a brother who is a monk, who is in a monastery. So it's as though they themselves were in the monastery. Huh? They've got their own representative there, a member of their family. And if some other member of the family wants to become a monk, they say, well, you better go to such and such monastery, because Uncle so-and-so is there. You go and be with him. He'll teach you. In this way, there's a very close connection, a very close link between the monks and the lay people. And, of course, most of the time, the monks are dependent for their economic support on the laity, though perhaps to a lesser extent than the monks of Southeast Asia. Because in Southeast Asia, for some reason or other, a tradition has grown up that it's a disgrace for a monk to work or to do anything with his hands, even kindle a fire. But it's not like that in Tibet. In Tibet, a monk can work at certain things. He can be a doctor, he can be a carpenter, he can be a painter, and he can be a monk at the same time. Now, the laity, for the most part, are dependent on the monks for spiritual guidance and spiritual help and advice. And they often go to the gompas. They often go to visit the monks, to consult them, to attend pujas, to participate in processions, to listen to lectures and so on. And they often invite the monks to their homes. The monks are free to go out during the day wherever they like, practically, in between services. Or they can even get leave of absence for the whole day or even for a few weeks or months, if necessary, to go to the house of some lay person, stay there, conduct services, teach, and so on. So there's a constant coming and going, the lay people going to the monasteries and the monks going to the homes of the lay people. And the spiritual connection, we may say, is even closer. In Theravada countries in Southeast Asia, they tend to divide the monks from the lay people rather sharply. There the view is that the monk is aiming at nirvana, at enlightenment, but the poor layman, he can't aim at that. He must aim just at a good rebirth. He'll have to come back anyway, poor chap. So he'd better aim at just a good rebirth in a decent, middle-class, well-to-do family that can send him to a good school and get him a good job and marry him off properly at the right time. That's the best he can hope for, a good rebirth. It's only the monks who can aspire to nirvana. This is the usual Theravada view. So this tends to introduce a distinction, not to say a cleavage, between the monks who aim at nirvana on the one hand and the lay people aiming at a good rebirth merely on the other. But it isn't like this in Tibet. Tibet doesn't just follow the Theravada, doesn't just follow the Hinayana, it follows the Mahayana plus the Vajrayana. And according to Tibetan Buddhism, all people equally are aiming or should aim at enlightenment, at full enlightenment, at Buddhahood. And therefore we find that all Tibetan Buddhists, whether monks, whether lay people, accept the Bodhisattva ideal. They accept that all of them ultimately should aspire to gain enlightenment for the benefit and the welfare of all living beings. And serious Tibetan Buddhists, whether monks or whether lay people, they take the Bodhisattva initiation and the Bodhisattva vow. The vow that I will not strive for enlightenment just for my own sake, but for the sake of all living beings in the universe whatsoever. And at this time, when they take the Bodhisattva initiation, when they make the Bodhisattva vow, they undertake to observe the Bodhisattva silas, or Bodhisattva precepts. And in the Tibetan tradition, there are 18 major Bodhisattva precepts and 46 minor ones. And I'm going to conclude by quoting just a few of them, because they constitute a common factor in the spiritual life of monks and lay people alike in Buddhist Tibet. In fact, we may say that these Bodhisattva precepts have helped to mould the whole character, the whole nature of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, the first major sila is a very simple one. It's very simple, very easy in a way, easy to understand, not easy to practice. It says, not to praise oneself and disparage others. Not to praise oneself and disparage others. And if you think of it, usually, in one way or another, consciously or unconsciously, we're doing this all the time, either individually or collectively, trying to exalt ourselves, as it were, and depreciate others, either our own country and other countries, our own religion and other religions, our own school and other schools, or just our own self and our friends and our enemies, and so on. So therefore, this first of the major precepts says, not to praise oneself, not to depreciate others. And we find, in fact, that the Tibetans are very, very unwilling to criticize. I remember one of my own Tibetan students came to me horrified from the local bazaar where he heard a Christian preacher. And he said, "What do you think? What do you think I heard today?" So I said, "Well, what?" He said, "I heard a man criticizing religion." Huh? And this is something that Tibetans just can't do. For them, it's unthinkable to criticize somebody else's religion, somebody else's faith. Now, precept number 11 of the major precepts says not to instruct in the doctrine of the void, shunyata, anyone who is not psychologically prepared for it. Teaching must be adjusted to the psychological and spiritual needs of the person concerned. Precept 14 says not to disparage the Hinayana. It may not be so highly developed as the Mahayana. It may be, comparatively speaking, a stepping stone to the Mahayana. But a stepping stone is a stepping stone. It's indispensable. You can't do without it. You might just as well abuse the lower rungs of the ladder and say that the higher rungs are more important. But without those lower rungs, you'd never get to the higher rungs. So no disparagement of the Hinayana. 18, not to give up the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta is the thought of the will to enlightenment for the benefit of all. Not to give this up. However difficult things may be, however impossible other people may be, never give up the thought, never give up the idea that one day they too will realize enlightenment, will come to Buddhahood. Now, among the minor offenses for one who has taken the Bodhisattva vow are, first of all, not to show respect for seniors, that are to say in Bodhisattva ordination, to despise evildoers. This is very easy, to look down on other people because you think that they're less virtuous than you. Well, they may be, but that's no reason for looking down on them. Then another one, to laugh heedlessly. It doesn't say that you shouldn't laugh, but it says you shouldn't laugh, if you're a bodhisattva or aspirant bodhisattva, heedlessly, without awareness. And then another one, not to pacify those who have become angry. If you see people angry in your vicinity, in your neighborhood, you should try to pacify their anger. Anger is the worst of all mental states, according to the Mahayana. There's nothing worse than anger, nothing worse than hate. So if there's even a hint of it in your surroundings, try to pacify, try to bring it down, try to reduce it. And then it's an offense also to neglect the sick. Here we come to something very practical, very down to earth. An offense to neglect the sick. And then it's an offense not to work for one's own circle of disciples and students and so on. So these are just some of the Bodhisattva precepts illustrating the spirit of Tibetan Buddhism, illustrating the common ideal of monks and laymen alike in Buddhist Tibet, illustrating the ideal, the Bodhisattva ideal, the ideal of enlightenment for the benefit of all, which brings monks and laity very close together indeed in Buddhist Tibet. And we may say that if relations between monks and laity, indeed relations between all degrees and all grades of the order, of our Western Buddhist order, here in this small corner of the Buddhist world, here in England, here in London, can live up to the standard of Tibet and be inspired by the same great spiritual ideal, the Bodhisattva ideal, then the success of this movement of ours is assured.